Good afternoon, Slanjava to you all, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz. We're coming to you live from a well-entrenched cinder block bunker that would rival the Diefen bunker in its tensile strength. Speaking of tensile strength, joining me from the north end in his Lexan cube is Adam A. Donaldson on the Skype line. Adam, are you there?
Who told you about the cube?
Oh, I thought it was public knowledge. Sorry, I'm sorry I revealed your you got those little things like Superman has, and that's how you manipulate all of your devices, right? The
that's
Fortress
more
of
or less.
Solid Fortress of Lexan. You can just steal that or whatever.
That's more or less accurate. Yeah.
Yikes. Yes. So coming up in the second half of the program, Adam spoke to Diane Sachs, the deputy leader of the Green Party of Ontario. Very much looking forward to that. And before that, we're going to talk a bit about the coup in Myanmar. A surprise? Maybe. Depends who you ask. And but before that, and off the top, we are going to discuss once again the COVID situation in Canada, but in particular the federal response to it, which has been, let's just say it's being met with, shall we call it mixed reviews, Adam?
I think that's fair.
So some of the things have happened this week. The restrictions put on international travel, the airports in particular, to sunny southern climes. I think they were taking that step in the lead up to the March break, which, as we know, the last March break was pretty much responsible for the first wave of the initial introduction, at least, to COVID in the nation. So this may be a preemptive move on their part.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the other piece of this, too, is and that plays into the news today, that we're not going to be getting as many shots of the Moderna vaccine as we thought we were in the weeks to come. Although, I mean, I read the numbers and it's something like 330,000 for Canada in not next week, but the week after, then 400,000 shots the week after that. And I mean, I don't know how quickly or how many people were thinking, but that doesn't actually sound too bad to me. Am I crazy?
No, like, as people know, I'm not a glass half full person at all. But no, like, quite literally not. Born skeptic, you name it. But when taking a long view on this, we could have potentially come into 2021 with nothing. We could have come into 2021 with zero. Every time I hear that, even if it's 10 people are vaccinated, or a certain, there was a story on CBC about a veteran's place in Ottawa where all the residents are vaccinated, the staff are vaccinated, they're opening things up a little bit and they're starting to have interactions again that they weren't having before. To me, that's a good news story. It's a small one, and these are incremental things. But
I think there's a matter of scale in this, too. And you know, that is, Canada has 35, 36, 37 million people.
Yeah.
And we have two companies that are basically vaccinating the whole world right now, although the UK does have access to a third vaccine, which we haven't approved yet. But I mean, I feel like we keep comparing ourselves, and I see this chart come up every night at the news. It's like, we only have such and such number of people per capita vaccinated as compared to Israel. And it's like, well, Israel's 9 million people. There are as many people in Israel as there are in, like, the GTHA. If you include, like, the expanded area of, like, Hamilton and things, that's Israel. It's just that area around Lake Ontario. So, I mean, you can't really go and say, well, Israel has almost all its people vaccinated. And then say, well, look at how bad we're doing. And it's like, well, yeah, if Canada was just focused on vaccinating Southern Ontario, we'd probably be looking pretty good too. But we have 37 million people spread out over thousands of square kilometers of space. You know, give us. I mean, we're not in the business of carrying water for the government, but I mean, give the government some credit.
Well, yeah, that's the, and there's several hundred health departments across the nation running this. Many, many layers to it. So to just kind of lay blame on the feds, it's getting, having to listen to O'Toole and company, to me, is it's getting pretty tiresome. Like it's a one note thing because whoever the government was or is in Canada right now would have been in the exact same situation. So the Liberals said, okay, we're going to do this broad spectrum thing. We're going to get absolutely every possible option available. And one of them is, well, the optics aren't very good. The COVAX supply, because that scheme was supposedly, I think, designed to get vaccines to poor countries. The headline in the BBC was, Canada defends taking vaccines from scheme for poor. So, terrible optics. The actual article itself does not say that. It's almost clickbait within the BBC website. And they go on to defend as to why they signed up for the program. There's other countries that had signed up for that program. New Zealand, notably, and Singapore, both wealthy places. I mean, but they're, you know, they keep harping on the fact that, well, Canada is a G7 nation. We're a G7 nation by accident, pretty much. And that we could probably spend a chunk of the show talking about that. But that, we'll leave that there for now. But, yeah, so this is the thing. And the other the news that domestic vaccine production is going to be happening, albeit at the end of the year, which means it'll be December 31st, or it'll be later, because the building that they're converting, the National Research Council building in Montreal, currently looks like the Guelph Police Station in terms of its the amount of construction. They decided to do this, but because it's not up to 2021 spec, they've had to rebuild. But at least it's happening. Now, you could argue, you could say, when we saw this looming on the horizon and everything was happening that happened almost a year ago right now, would have been the time to reboot that production. But again, back then they didn't know how it was going to go, so they said, okay, we'll just take all the vaccines. And, you know, not to mention Sputnik V is supposedly, according to The Lancet, hitting the mark. So that's Russia taken care of. China have their own sets of vaccines, which we were supposed to be involved with, but it failed. You know, geopolitics, you name it, whatever, but they're doing that concurrently. So it's not as if, you know, we tend to, the comparisons, like you said, Israel and all that, we tend to compare Canada to everyone. It's like, can we just sort of concentrate on getting this done, and let's not worry about Israel, let's not worry about, well, like, let's just get at her.
Well, we're constantly being victimized by our own short-sightedness with these things. And, you know, one of the reasons why we don't have vaccine production in Canada is because years ago a decision was made that, you know, global supply chain is being made in other places. So why would we bother having our own facilities to make vaccine? And this is, you know, what happens. And I believe Aaron O'Toole's old boss, you know, had some hand in that decision. The other thing, too, is I can't remember the other thing, too. But I mean, to get to your point, though, it's constantly been a struggle to get people to understand sort of the long term thinking about this. And the National Research Council is another prime decision. You have people complaining. It's like, well, it's not going to do us any good now. Like, are they producing vaccines tomorrow? No. Then why are we even bothering? And it's like, well, who knows what's going to happen? Because as we're seeing, one of the things that this is being framed as, it's the battle between vaccination and the variants. And it's like, well, if this is going to be a thing where COVID is going to be constantly mutating and changing, does it not behoove us to sort of have options? And does it not sort of behoove us to think, if this is going to be a multi-year problem and a multi-year vaccination process, like something like the flu, should we not have that capacity to generate stuff in our own backyard in the future, even if it's not today? Like people think, like, June, everybody will be vaccinated and it's over. Or September, everyone will be vaccinated and it's over. And the message from scientists is, no, this is going to be a year's recovery, because as we've seen, we already have like three, and I love when I hear Anthony Fauci say it, mutants. We have three. We have three mutants.
That mutants. Yeah, yeah. They're coming.
It does sound like he's going to announce plans to go after the X-Men next, but it does slay a claim. Like, we're still thinking short term. This is a longer term problem, and thus there's really no problem in thinking about longer term capacity like that. And on top of this, I will add, I think there are legitimate things we can criticize the government about. I think one of them is, I think we should see those contracts. I think we should have a better understanding of what the contracts are. When I turn into Power and Politics and I see, government ministers being asked, like, well, are there late penalties for if Pfizer or Moderna doesn't deliver vaccines on time? And they basically say, well, I don't know. It's like, well, who does know? Who's read these contracts? Maybe we should all see the contracts, just in the interest of like opening. I'm not alleging a conspiracy, but you know, it's a government, we're a democracy, let's see some transparency. And then the other thing is that we've been so preoccupied with the half measures that when the government does hammer down on something like travel, people start getting really, really pissy. And we see that with the Snowbirds Association saying, oh, we don't want to quarantine when we come back. And it's like, well, why did you leave the country in the first place? I was watching the news on the weekend and they were talking to this woman leaving Pearson, going to Germany. And she's like, well, they better not make me stay in a hotel when I get back or I'm going to talk to my lawyer.
It's oh,
like,
yeah.
Are you kidding me?
And she wasn't wearing a mask either. I saw. Yeah.
She wasn't wearing a mask.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay, boomer. Yeah, exactly. That phrase was designed for that particular woman. And you're right. I mean, that's, we don't want to quarantine. And there was that, what were they calling it? They were heading down to get vaccines specifically in Florida because they're just vaccinating everybody, which I believe may or may not have stopped. Yeah, that entitled to the entitlements approach does not reflect well on this nation or those people in particular. Like, we do have a long tradition. I know there was a story, I think it was on CBC, about Jamaica and how they're going to lose millions from everything that's going on. There are a lot of people losing millions. And the government's job, part of their job, too, is to accommodate and take care of those millions. I'm thinking particular, not just of small business, but of the workers as well, right? It's like, we've had the benefits. People are on EI now. What is the next thing? Haven't really heard. And as you said, this is a long thing. So yeah, it's not going to be as if we're all going to get vaccinated and then it is over. We still need to take the provisions. It will get better as we're getting vaccinated. Those timeline things are saying, we're not going to be vaccinated until 2030 at this rate. I think within the next month or two, we're going to see the country awash in vaccines. Once production ramps up here and there, once the other things are approved, it's going to start happening. But the focus should be on it being targeted to certain groups in particular. Like, I think I heard it today that not everyone in Ontario in long-term care is vaccinated. That's 80% of the people that are dying. They have to do that. And they have to vaccinate people that are potentially heading into long-term care, because there's a whole ton of them as well. They'll come back from Florida and then they'll have to go into long-term care, right? So it's...
Well, to give people a kind of an idea of that, because I was on the Board of Health call yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
89% of the people who have died from COVID in Wellington, Dufferin, Guelph are people over 65. The other 11% are people between the ages of 60 and 65. So, and Dr. Mercer has made this point that, this is a disease that doesn't affect all people equally. And I think that's the valid point. I will say to your point that apparently public health has given every resident in long-term care in Wellington, Dufferin, Guelph the first shot of the Pfizer vaccine. They are now in the process of giving out the second shot, and they have been, whatever vaccines they've gotten in the last couple of weeks, they've been holding back so they can make sure people get their follow-up shots.
And that's good news. And because you get significant protection from just the one shot, it would seem, compared to nothing at all, right?
Well, I believe all the studies were based on two shots. Mm-hmm. They weren't based on one shot, which is why, I mean, that's why the recommendations are what they are. They're not saying don't give the vaccine to people under 18 because we studied that. They're saying don't give the vaccine to people under 18 because people under 18 were never tested the vaccine. It's ethical reasons. You don't obviously test on children. So I think I think one of the things I come back to is, you know, something that I've been thinking about all along is that we're watching the scientific process work in real time. The scientific process isn't always perfect or immediate. The science has to happen in its own time, and it's not responsive to people's impatience. And I think that's we're really feeling the stress of that at this point. People are just utterly impatient. It's like, I get it, I'm impatient too, except I don't want to go to Bermuda. I wouldn't mind like an afternoon in downtown Toronto for a change, or uptown Waterloo.
Or going to a store and not being terrified that a variant is going to get
plane. You. Yeah. I wouldn't mind going to a movie theater again. That would be nice. That'd be a nice treat for me.
Yeah, when you take stock like that, you're so right. It's yeah. When they speak to people at the airport, and I hear whining, like as you mentioned that one particular person, but you do hear it. It's just like, just shut up, is my opinion and approach to that. But obviously, a continuing story, and I think COVID will be our Trump of the next however many.
Oh man.
I hadn't really thought about the guy, but we don't need to think about him. But something that we should sorry,
impeachment next week.
Oh yeah, okay. I think I know what one of our topics might be for next week, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. And speaking of, we'll see what happens. A coup in Myanmar. Myanmar wasn't really on anyone's radar for this. I don't think they were on the radar recently, however, for what is being called a genocide of the Rohingya people, one of the many, many ethnic groups in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. And sorry, I sometimes use the two interchangeably, so I may say one or the other, but it's not to offend anybody. This coup had happened, military junta taken control. It sounds like they had never completely given up control after making these supposedly democratic changes. A thin veneer of democracy smeared itself across the country. The famous Aung San Suu Kyi has been arrested, along with President Mint. Is it Mint was his name? Yeah. And they obviously had to place charges on them. I should mention Aung San Suu Kyi is like a, she seems to be a bit of an untouchable and untouchable. That's not to say something couldn't, you know, Navalny style couldn't happen to her, but she's almost worshipped, I think, by the people of Myanmar. And so it would be a bad move on the military's part if anything happened to her. Having said that, this is someone who was given honorary Canadian citizenship for her, and a Nobel Peace Prize for her efforts for human rights. But when the genocide, massacre, assault, rape of the Rohingya people started, she didn't say too much. So we sort of knew from that who was really controlling the situation. I don't think the military has ever yielded control in Myanmar. So the coup is just kind of like, is it a coup, or are they just sort of, you know, restaking the claim on what they already control?
Yeah, they're sorting some stuff out, to quote a line from John Wick. It does feel that way, and it feels like this is a kind of response to them losing control a bit, because they were basically transitioned to a civilian controlled government in 2011. There was an election in 2015, and that's when Suu Kyi and her party won the election. It was fairly decisive, and then there was an election in the fall, and that was basically a landslide election. Suu Kyi and her party got a massive endorsement from the Myanmar people, was reelected, and that's, I think, probably when the military started thinking coup, because, I mean, the timing is interesting. Basically, the new government was going to be, I'm not sure what the phrase they use, like sworn in, read in, or, you know, whatever induction ceremony they have for the new government. That was supposed to be on Monday. And of course, when did the coup happen? And what happened? Well, I guess in our time, Sunday, but I guess it was early morning on Monday, their time. So, yeah, clearly this had been in the works for a while. And I mean, and I would also add too that this has a kind of familiar tinge to it, because the opposition USDP party, which has deep ties to the Myanmar military, were leveling accusations for months about electoral fraud and a stolen election,
the likes of which they've never seen, right? Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's almost a direct quote. I mean, mm-hmm. granted, in the local dialect, but yeah, that's kind of where everything was. And then the Election Commission dismissed all the allegations, and then it seemed to be go time. So, I mean, it's sadly now become a familiar story of opposition parties violently reacting to democratic elections.
Yeah, so the charges they've been hauled in on are really slim. Bizarrely, the one against Aung San Suu Kyi was for having a pair of walkie-talkies. What was it? Violating import laws? Like, mm-hmm. what do you get for that? Do you get a mm-hmm. citation, or do you get house arrest for the rest of your life? Because she was on house arrest for many, many years, right? Same mm-hmm. with President Mint, violating the natural disaster management law. It's like they went to this dusty book, probably from colonial times, and said, what can we charge these people with? So
it's the equivalent of the police officer coming up to your car, pulling you over and going, oh, you have a busted taillight, and you saying, no, I don't. And then they break the taillight in front of you.
Yes, which has been in several films, among other. That's all. Yes. I see is the state trooper going, now. Rocky? I don't know. First Blood? It doesn't matter.
First Blood is the Rambo.
First Rambo. Turn into end credits there for a brief, brief moment in time. So, yeah, this is quite ridiculous charges that, I mean, obviously they'll be able to make them stand up because they are in charge. And I didn't know this. It seems the military there has like a permanent amount of seats in the parliament. It's something to the tune of 25%. Mm-hmm. You mentioned their party, Union Solidarity and Development Party, got clobbered in the election to the point where it sounds like they were surprised by the amount of seats that they lost. There's a certain number that's a tipping point between the seats that they have plus the seats that they might get, that they would have maintained a certain amount of control in the parliament, and that was a flop. So of course they started to get nervous. Something to mention too, because people know generally about the Rohingya, there's Myanmar, I think it's upwards of 130 plus different distinct ethnic groups, either by language or by grouping. It's that kind of place for centuries. It's been a back and forth. They've got Bangladesh on the one side where the Rohingya went, China on the other side.
Yeah. Colonial borders,
exactly, because the nation state is like whatever. But the Koh Kang people suffered from the same kind of attacks, and I believe it was roughly the same time as the Rohingya, who are ethnic Chinese in Myanmar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's pretty ballsy to take on China or a Chinese ethnic minority right on those borders. So China is not quite kid gloves on Myanmar, but at the UN Security Council, if I understand it right, China and Russia took a bit of a step back from having officially sanctioning Myanmar on this. They were sort of like, well...
Yeah, they used their veto.
They used their veto, which they've had for... forever, pretty much, citing stability reasons, so which is fairly vague. It's pretty much their way of saying, we don't really want to get involved with this, so they probably strategically don't have any skin in the game, let's say, on what's going on there. It's kind of, oh, we'll let that play out. There are other places where we are doing stuff, but we're not going to worry about that. So it sounds like there isn't going to be, you know, the UN could have a resolution on this, and as we know with UN security resolutions, it's kind of like, okay, whatever. would anything come of it? Would anything happen from it? Probably not. That kind of thing would come and go. It doesn't sound like there's anybody wanting to have any kind of intervention in Myanmar. So this one-year cap on the junta, which is probably not remotely accurate. They're just saying that for now, but who knows how long this could go on, really.
it is interesting, sort of the lack of reaction. There was widespread condemnation, of course, but I mean, even inside the country, because you think party wins in a landslide, there would be a lot of outrage. And it's not that there isn't outrage, but it's not like we're out in the streets kind of outrage. There's a lot of, you know, little small acts of civil disobedience, like people not showing up for work, people banging pots and pans and honking horns at sundown and things like that. But I think there's this kind of a widespread wait and see attitude. And one of the things that was noted, the general who took over, and I don't know if I'm going to say his name right, but Monsu or Mon.
It's Mon Liang, Hong I Lang. Think. Liang? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
He's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, and he's now basically in charge. But he turned 65 this year, and apparently there's like a mandatory retirement if you hit 65 and you're in the Myanmar military. So he's basically bought himself another year on the job, declaring a state of emergency and after a coup d'etat. And I do wonder how much of this is perhaps just like his immediate reaction, just like I'm not ready to give up power yet. And, you know, maybe it is a matter of like buying himself a year. And, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of unanswered questions here. And I think a lot of that is just being driven by the seeming ambivalence, just another coup. Which, you know, maybe if you live in Myanmar long enough, it just becomes another coup. And, well, like, you know, being under military rule is like putting on an old sweater. I don't know.
Well, for the most of modern Myanmar, formerly Burma, that's all that they've known once mm-hmm. the British left in 1948. And it was Aung San Suu Kyi's father who was one of the people trying to arrange Myanmar's or Burma at that time's independence, and he was assassinated before it even became the country that we know today. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that it started on that kind of note, has only known military rule for most of its time. It sounds like they decided to open up because of the usual things. There's sanctions and all those. Turned into a bit of a backwater, let's say, both economically and, you know, if they're shutting you down for various reasons. I think that's maybe possibly why the military decided that they needed to open up things, or at least give the illusion that things are opening up, because, you know, if you're not functioning, I think, was it around 08? Like, it was around everything was going for, you know, going south. They have resources, so it's not, you know, it's not as if that they couldn't have a working modern economy if they wanted one, by the sounds of it. But mm-hmm. this does sound that, you know, the power grab must be to line something up for the general where they can stay out of it. It's a Putin style where you can only be present twice, then you disappear, then you come back, and then you know there's some it's shenanigans going on, right? But it's not just him. I mean, there's a network of the military, and that photo that was bizarre, that the photo that you used, but I watched the bit too of the aerobic, you know, something very benign and normal going on, like an aerobics class, with the trucks going on in the background, and it's like they seem to be, or they were some semblance of normal, and then boom, just gone. So speaking of getting gone, yes, we're going to take a bit of a break for a few announcements, a little bit of music, so we can take a breather and Adam can open the cube and let some fresh air in, as we're supposed to do these days. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. We'll be back in short order, so please stick around. Records pick of the week, Royal Cat Records, Little Big Record Shop on 21 Mac Donnell. That was the late, the great Mel Brown one of the first artists I ever saw in this town, actually. I think he opened up the eyes to a lot of people attending University of Guelph for the first time to the blues had they never experienced it, and that song was called Pattern B. So, Mel Brown, for those of you who've been in Guelph for a long time, will remember the great Mel Brown. And, yeah, sorry, I got a little carried away there. I thought it was a music DJ for a second, Adam, but we're not. This is Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU. And, Adam, you spoke to Diane Sachs.
Yes, Diane Sachs, who is currently the Deputy Leader of the Green Party of Ontario, formerly the Environmental Commissioner of Ontario. And so she has a lot to say about the current environmental policy of the provincial government and why she is now in politics. And, well, I think that cues it up.
Right on. Let's get to that now.
Diane Sachs, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I guess to start off with, one of the things I've been thinking about environmentally speaking is, and Mike kind of addressed this on the weekend, he was posting about litter, you know, finding masks on the ground, and I guess people feeling a bit more free to litter given the times. I mean, do you have any kind of specific concerns just kind of sitting here on a Tuesday thinking about, you know, what the environmental effects of the pandemic are going to be in terms of like the more waste that's been created, all the masks, all the gloves, all the empty plastic bottles of hand sanitizer? You know, do you have a sense of what the long-term environmental effects of the pandemic are going to be?
The masks on the ground, the waste and so on, it's ugly. And the bigger problem with plastic litter is it gets washed into our water courses where it chokes fish and can be incredibly difficult and expensive to try to clean up afterwards. So we will have, I expect, more plastic waste to deal with for a long time. I've heard geologists speculate, well, what will be left 10,000 or 10 million years from now to show that we were here? Well, they said in the deep ocean, we'll have a layer of plastic and a layer of radioactive fallout. That's what we're going to leave behind. So plastic does matter. We use it for a minute or an hour, and then it can be around for 1,000 years. But the larger impact of the pandemic, I fear, is going to be the loss of momentum towards climate action. Because the climate crisis is not slowing down. The climate crisis is accelerating. And the scientists have showed us over and over again that time is of the essence, that every year that we waste now, we're going to pay for really heavily. It's a little bit the same experience we've had with COVID, that when we delay taking action on COVID, because COVID grows exponentially, the pain and the cost are enormously greater a little while later. Well, it's the same with climate. And we've had many governments using the pandemic as an excuse for putting off climate action. We certainly see that in Ontario. We also have the knock-on effects of the enormous economic crisis. So you see cities being devastated by the financial losses from COVID, which is seriously interfering with their ability to get on with the kind of investments we need to do to reduce our carbon footprint and to get ready for the increasingly severe hammer blows that climate is bringing us. So much as I detest the plastic, I am much more worried about the climate.
And I even saw that in the White House press briefing last week. There was a reporter that was asking about Joe Biden passing these executive orders to fight climate change. And the question was framed like, how can we spend more money fighting climate change when we're already spending all this money fighting COVID? And like the two issues have been sort of set against each other in some realms. We can either spend money on climate change, we can spend money on COVID. We can't do both.
Well, the suggestion that there's a zero-sum game is really dangerous. A zero-sum game is posited often as between COVID and climate. We also often hear it posited as between economic and racial inequality and climate, that there's a zero sum, we can only do one, and the one that's most important to whoever is speaking is whichever one it is, and so the other one should wait. We will not prosper with that approach. We have to insist on looking for the opportunities where action on one makes the other better. Mm-hmm. I'm spending a lot of time thinking about exactly that question. How do we look for win-wins? Because if this is a zero-sum game, the future is going to be awful. Mm-hmm. The only way we have a good future is if we take the multiple crises that are ahead of us right now and look for common solutions. I know a few examples. Certainly, I'd like to have more, but one of the simplest examples is thinking about low-income housing. People who live in low-income housing usually live there because it's cheap and they have no alternative, but very often these are old buildings, badly built, not maintained. They leak heat, so they're cold and drafty in the winter. They're oppressively hot in the summer. And they're very, very expensive to heat at all. This is bad for the people who live there. It's bad for who is ever paying for the cost of the building. And it's bad for pollution. So putting some capital into making these buildings efficient has multiple benefits. And we saw this under cap and trade. Three-quarters of the money under Ontario's cap and trade program went to the public sector, like social housing, municipalities, school boards, and so on, to do things like insulate social housing. And what we saw in those projects was that the cost of operating the buildings was cut often roughly in half. The people who lived in the buildings for the first time had a reasonable temperature all year round, which was better for their health, better for their dignity, treated them with respect. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about solutions where we do multiple things at the same time is, I think, our way forward.
And I think that fits very nicely at the intersection of trying to build recovery post-COVID too, because I know one of the things that the party's been pushing for is energy home retrofits as a way of creating jobs, as a way of building resiliency, as a way of building recovery from the pandemic. That's kind of one of the things that scratches all the itches, because you are making life more affordable for people, you are improving the environment, and you're creating jobs to put people back to work in one thing that scratches both COVID recovery, environmental justice, and also improving the lives of low-income people.
And it's not just jobs. These are good careers. Mm-hmm. These are good careers where people can be proud of their skills and in which they make almost immediate positive differences to the lives of the people in their community. I've heard some wonderful stories. One of the stories I told on my podcast, Green Economy Heroes, I did an interview with Sean Loney of Aki Energy. And it's because of Aki Energy that more than half of the certified geothermal installers in Manitoba are Indigenous people who had barriers to employment. And by creating this program whereby now I think six reserves have significant geothermal heat, he told me the people who used to be ashamed in front of their family are now, I mean, they're now heroes to their family. They have regular jobs. They bring in a good income. They support their family. And they visibly make their community better for everybody who lives around them. It gives them a reason to be proud. It gives the people around them a reason to be proud. And there's the opportunity to repeat that story over and over again. And we need all those pieces.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's a growing area too. And thinking a lot about the coverage of again, not to revisit American politics too much, but you know, you had Joe Biden signing an order to rescind the permit for Keystone XL, and there's a lot of, well, what about all those jobs? And here's an example of an area where we're we should be looking for more jobs, areas like geothermal, different areas where the energy practices are a bit more sustainable. And to your point too, this is not a program that there was a government handout that allowed these people to launch their business. They saw a need in their community and were able to launch a business, and while also being environmentally sustainable at the same time.
Yeah, so that's what I'm doing in the podcast. I'm interviewing people right across Canada who are green business leaders. And it's really exciting to discover how many different kinds of approaches there are, how many different kinds of businesses, how many different kinds of backgrounds and skills that people have. In terms of Keystone, what tends to be forgotten in all the publicity about the pipeline is the jobs associated with the pipeline were almost entirely construction jobs, like very temporary, very short-term jobs. The total number of people, I think, expected to operate the pipeline was, I think, 35, plus a small number of outside contractors doing some part-time work. It was never going to be a major job creator. But construction makes a lot of work for a short period of time. Are there things we need to build? Absolutely, there are things we need to build. There's a lot of infrastructure we need for a low carbon society. And we also need a huge amount of infrastructure to be able to withstand the hammer blows that are coming. The Insurance Bureau of Canada estimated that Canadian municipalities already need $5.3 billion a year, most of that in infrastructure spending, to cope with the impacts of that climate change that are already here. So instead of building destructive things, we need to build things, and we can build things that make our lives better. Clean the air, give us a better community where we are. And the air, I mentioned the air because people tend not to be aware how much fossil fuel pollution is adversely affecting our health. It's huge. The federal government has issued reports showing the billions of dollars in economic damage from direct damage to health from people driving around in diesel and gasoline cars and trucks. That's associated with dementia. It's associated with many things that drive up the cost of our healthcare system and just make your life miserable. I mean, taking care of somebody with dementia is no fun, and the number of people with dementia is growing all the time. And we know that air pollution from fossil fuel vehicles is one of the large contributing factors to increasing the rates of dementia. This is not good for our economy if you count everything. It only looks good in the short term if you keep your eyes firmly shut to most of the consequences.
You were talking about being willfully blind, and from your position, you had a desk where it was your job to hold the government to account on environmental matters. So you kind of had, perhaps a better look than those of us in the general public. Are they willfully blind, do you think, or do you think that there's maybe just a lack of imagination on the part of the people in power right now that I guess maybe they're just not thinking for far enough ahead. Like we're used to a world where we drive everywhere. We have people in charge who can't possibly imagine a world that's not like that.
I think you're talking about the Ford government.
Yes.
I was the Environmental Commissioner of Ontario, responsible for reporting to the Ontario legislature on the government's progress on energy, environment, and climate. I feel confident that the Ford government knows what the consequences of their actions will be. I know many of the extremely dedicated, high integrity civil servants who work in the Ontario government who are knowledgeable about the environmental and climate crisis and who will have done everything in their power to make sure that all of the information is put before the, this government. So it's not that they don't know. Mm. It's that they have deliberately chosen to reject science, to reject the evidence of the consequences of their choices in order to achieve short-term benefits for a comparatively small number of people. So I have said many times that real estate development is Ontario's oil sands. And it's our oil sands in that it is the largest driver of our climate and environmental crisis. It's also extremely economically powerful, extremely politically powerful because of the large donations that are provided from that industry. And I do not ever recall in my life seeing a government as determined to do everything possible for the benefit of the development industry, no matter what the cost is to anyone else, than the Ford government. The use of ministerial zoning orders to bulldoze aside any environmental concerns, any public concerns, any good planning, which is being done all over this province, even in provincially significant wetlands, which we desperately depend on to withstand what climate change is bringing us, among other things, can only be justified if all that matters is allowing your friends and donors to make a lot of money in the short term, and you don't care what the consequences will be. It is all well documented.
I ask because, you know, there are multiple forms of ignorance, as you know. Like, there's the kind of willful ignorance you're talking about, and then there's kind of the ignorance that can be addressed through education. And I guess, I think for people who are concerned about the environment, the way you're talking, the way to address environmental concerns is to have this government not be in power in 2022.
Well, I agree with that.
Okay.
I don't think this government is ignorant, willfully or otherwise. They have been told they choose to act otherwise deliberately. It's not a question of ignorance. I have seen, what has this government done on any energy, environment and climate topic that is positive since they were elected? I'm hard pressed to think of anything. I mean, there was one or two things they didn't actively break. But there are no new initiatives that they've done that are good. Everything that they've done has been harmful. They repealed our climate law. They canceled the hundreds of excellent climate programs that we had. They canceled 752 clean power contracts for power that we're going to need. They've spent $1 billion of public money buying gas plants so that we'll have more dirty electricity. They're spending many billions of dollars a year of taxpayers' money. That's money they're taking out of your pocket and mine to subsidize electricity rates, which mostly goes to assist the wealthier. They've increased speed limits. They're turbocharging urban sprawl. They're putting big box stores in provincially significant wetlands. They've hamstrung tribunals. They have starved the staff. I mean, it's they've cut off all funding for the Clean Water Act, because after all, why would we want safe drinking water? They repealed the Green Energy Act. They have eviscerated the Endangered Species Act. They have allowed developers to pay to kill species that can't recover. It's a consistent pattern, very Trump-like, of clear-cutting environmental regulations and institutions. Anything that stands in the way of developers making short-term money, doing what they want at the cost of everyone else, and particularly future generations and the other creatures with whom we share this beautiful province. They have been in the fields that I care about, they have been uniformly destructive.
I think I've forgotten about half the things you listed off, which, I mean, is a good segue to talk about looking to the future, because I think this time next year we will definitely be thinking about the provincial campaign, and you have already announced your intention to run and where you will be running. So I guess I want to look at this a couple of different ways. What do you anticipate the campaign to look like this time next year? I mean, COVID may not be entirely over by then. And then what do you think, I guess, what do you think you're going to specifically be trying to run on as a candidate once campaigning does begin?
Well, Adam, as you know, I'm a beginner as a politician.
Yes.
So there's lots of people who know more about this than I do. I've spent my entire working life for 45 years carefully avoiding political entanglements, and I'm only running now out of desperation. Well, as deputy leader of the Green Party, one of my roles is to think very hard about what's good climate policy and what ways are there to use good climate policy to trigger improvements on other major challenges that we have right now, which includes racial inequality, which includes how do we keep our main streets alive and vibrant after COVID. It includes things like the enormous mental health burden that we will all be trying to recover from as COVID recedes. I am certainly hoping that by this fall, we'll be able to have some kind of in-person outdoor interactions. I hope it'll be possible to knock on doors with a mask and retreat to a safe distance and talk to people respectfully. I hope it'll be possible to have some backyard gatherings to get to know people. But absolutely, my strength is on policy, on public policy, and on the law and how government and law actually works. That's what I've spent my whole career doing. And so I am hoping to talk to people, listen to people and talk to people about how do we build a good policy? What does it look like? What kind of things can we do even with an obstreperous government? Like, how do we get started now waiting for the government to change? Well, we can't wait anymore. And in particular, I am hoping to see strong leadership by young people. I heard a wonderful interview with Ed Markey on Generation Green New Deal, which is a great podcast about the youth climate movement in the United States. And his campaign and his political life was rescued by the Sunrise Movement by letting young people lead in the way that spoke to them. Because after all, it is young people who will live the consequences of our choices. Baby boomers like me, I mean, we are not going to live to see the worst of what's coming. We are not going to really live to pay the price of what we've done. And so we owe it to young people to do everything you can now to repair the damage that we've done and to lend them a hand. And I am calling on young people to step forward and lead, just as the Sunrise Movement has in the United States. So I have a youth council being organized. So people say to me, well, what will they do? And I say, I don't know. They haven't told me yet.
That's great. It sounds like you have a better handle on this politics stuff than you're giving yourself credit for.
Maybe. If there's anyone in your audience who'd like to help get me elected as the next Green MPP in Ontario, A, I can really need the help, and B, you'll have a good time. The website is Vote for Diane, VOTE FORDIANNE.ca, and you'll see there's lots of opportunities to get involved, and we have events. We even have a minister of fun. It's going to be a great campaign.
I appreciate your time, Diane, and I hope we get a chance to talk again before election time next year, and thank you for the time you gave me today. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Anytime.
Well, sounds like it was a little bit of a hack there, but I managed to fight them off. That was Adam speaking to Diane Sachs, the new deputy leader of the Green Party of Ontario. Sounds like they've picked up a bit of a heavy hitter there, Adam.
We will have to wait and see. At least in University Rosedale, where she's running.
All right. And just very quickly, before we close, speaking of heavy hitters, I wanted to send our condolences to the family and all those that knew Alan Pickersgill, who passed away this week at the age of 75. Anybody who's remotely involved with city politics, politics in this town over the past 40-plus years, we'll say, would have known Alan, and our hearts go out to his family and those that knew him.
Same. Yep.
You've been listening to Open Source's Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. We're heard here every Thursday at 5 p.m. Adam, if people wanted to reach you and find out what you do in your Lexan Cube, how do they do that?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to GuelphPolitico.ca.
I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and please check out CFRU.ca for the schedule of all of our shows and everything that's going on at the station remotely, but still going on. Programming continues even through these times. So thanks for joining us. Take care. Please join us next week, and all the best.